Welcome back to the Shanti Ma podcast. Today's episode is brought to you by Govinda. Govinda is an Austin-based producer, composer, and performer that features a passionate violin blended with global fusion and bass-filled sounds. The podcast intro song is actually provided by Govinda, so if you like what you're hearing, head on over to iTunes, SoundCloud, Spotify, YouTube, or Bandcamp and get your hands on some more Govinda music. Today's guest, Tamal Dodge. Tamal Dodge is revered as one of the youngest and most respected yoga teachers in the world right now. He's been featured in Time Magazine, the LA Times, New York Times, Chicago Tribune, CSNBC, Martha Stewart Living Radio, the Hay House Heal Summit, as well as many, many other international publications. He is the founder of Yoga Salt, a popular yoga center in Los Angeles, California, and is also the published author of The Yoga Plate, a book to bring your practice into the kitchen, written alongside his wife, Victoria. His teachings are thought-provoking and deeply insightful, spreading truth and enlightenment to those it reaches. Without further ado, please give a warm welcome to the lovely and wonderful Tamal Dodge. How are you doing?
Good. How are you? Does it sound okay?
Oh, it sounds great. Yeah. I'm just going to set a timer right now so that I don't get swept away with conversation here. Let me just make sure. There we go.
It's nice to finally meet you.
Yeah, you too. Thank you so much for joining me. I had seen you on the Heal Summit and I was saying to my boyfriend, I was like, finally, somebody who is actually talking about the Yoga Sutras.
Yeah, it doesn't happen very often.
No. And, you know, it's interesting because I took my yoga teacher training a few years ago in India, and then I was barely home. I think I was home for about 2 months and I had a car accident. And so not being able to actually do asanas anymore, I actually had to go within and start thinking about, well, what actually is yoga? And so I started over the last couple of years reading about the Yoga Sutras and kind of going within and doing the internal work. And then you got on there and you're talking and I'm like, he's preaching to the choir right now. So anyways, thank you for coming on.
Absolutely.
Yeah. So you can hear me okay as well?
Yeah, it sounds great.
Okay, perfect. So congratulations on your new book.
Thank you.
Yeah. What inspired you and Victoria to write that book?
Well, I've been doing yoga teacher trainings for a very long time now, about almost 16 years. And as we get kind of more in depth in this conversation, we'll address Patanjali's Eight Sutras and some foundational principles of yogic living, yoga philosophy, as people like to call it. But I like to kind of relate everything as to living, because the philosophy isn't supposed to be something we just sit around and talk about, but something that we apply into our life. And in Patanjali's Eight Sutras, the first thing he talks about is ahimsa, which means creating the least amount of harm as possible. Mm-hmm. And so throughout the years, I've been leading these yoga teacher trainings and going over Patanjali's Eight Sutras, but this very specific principle. And it's been something where students for so long have been asking me, well, I wish after training we could have some kind of a book and also maybe some recipes and things that we can take into our life so we can apply it and make it easier transition for ourselves. So for many years, we've been kind of thinking about, oh, wow, one day we should kind of put together a manual. We should start doing yoga diet workshops, besides just what we do in the teacher trainings. And my wife, Victoria, she's for many years been having kind of like a free blog. It used to be called Nourishment Now, where she would interview all these people in the plant-based community and she would do cooking classes. So probably a year and a half ago, she was out at lunch. Was that mine or your computer?
It was a ding. Was it mine? No, it wasn't mine, I don't think.
So she went out to a meal with one of our good friends, Liz Arch, and Liz Arch just got a book published, and they started talking about books that were kind of floating around that needed to be written. And Liz Arch was telling Victoria, well, you and Tamal should write a book on the yoga diet since it's such a big thing in your community and the things that you do. And Liz Arch was like, I'll give you our number to my agent and you guys can kind of see if she wants to represent you. And make a long story short, we had an interview with this agent. She loved everything that we were kind of offering and thought it was a really refreshing thing to hear somebody talking about, like you were saying, the Yoga Sutras and mm-hmm. how it applies to our life. And she started shopping around this concept. We put together a 72-page proposal for publishers wow. to look at, which was basically like writing a book.
Yeah, no kidding.
Full color with pictures and recipes. And Sounds True, which is a really great publisher, loved it, got the concept right away. And in a span of a year, we wrote an entire cookbook. Really, the cooking part was done in the span of a summer, but then the philosophy part and the introduction and things like that, we kind of took our time with. And now it's available everywhere. It's doing really well. We're seeing people purchase it from all over the globe, which is really exciting, meaning that people outside of just the U.S. are appreciating it, whether they're in Europe, Australia, Canada, all over are jumping on board with it and making the correlation that it's something that's kind of not spoken about. Mm-hmm. I think one of the reasons it's kind of avoided in a lot of the yoga community is because the topic makes Westerners uncomfortable.
Because it means changing.
Yeah, because we're raised to eat meat and potatoes and things mm-hmm. like that. And when you really dive deep into the yoga system, everything about it is kind of set in place to make us uncomfortable. The yoga postures are intense and uncomfortable. It's not like we're going to go to a vinyasa class and say, well, you know, I'm going to chill out for the next hour. You're going to be sweating. You're going to be in an awkward position. But at the end of it, the result is incredible. Mm-hmm. Well, the philosophy is so challenging. There's things that are going to really beckon change. And it's, requires us to look inward and look at these things that kind of hold us back and change not only the way we're going to live, but ultimately changes our consciousness and our perception of the world. So that was the outlook of the book. We've been kind of cataloging hundreds of recipes over the last like 15 years. So we're in the works of looking at doing another yoga plate cookbook for 2020. So.
Oh, that's amazing. I really need to get a copy of your book. I do.
I'll have to send you one.
Oh, I would love that. Oh my gosh. Yeah, I would absolutely love that. You know, it's interesting because that was something that I started exploring a little bit a few years ago with food and diet when I was in India in 2017. I had been suffering from like a lot of stomach issues and I had actually been trying to get off of birth control for a number of years. And every time I did, my hormones would go crazy. And I kept reaching, you know, I'd go to the doctor and they were just like, oh, well, you know, there's just nothing that you can do. Basically, either keep taking it or you take, you know, something like a, you know, Accutane, something very strong and intense. And so when I finally got to India, I actually went and did Panchakarma with an Ayurvedic doctor. Everyone kept recommending that I go and see this doctor. And, you know, I finally went and saw him and stomach issues that I had had, skin issues, hormone issues. And it was just one of the most intense and spiritual experiences I've ever had just from changing my diet. It started to change my consciousness. And even just, that sort of process of detoxing, the amount of things that come out of your mind and surface. And I kind of started playing around with that. So I feel like we need more of that in the yoga community. I think we need more of that in just life in general. People need to be more conscious about what they put into their bodies, which I guess kind of brings me to a really good question. So how do you feel about a person's diet affecting their state of consciousness?
This is something we talk about a lot just in seminars and workshops and yoga trainings. The word yoga, most people think it means to connect with breath, to unite with body and breath. But when you start to read like the Bhagavad Gita, if people aren't familiar with the Bhagavad Gita, it's like the equivalent to the Bible in our culture as it is to yoga. You start to understand the actual literal translation, which means to yoke or unite with God, to connect with God. And the word yogi means one who's on the path to connecting with God. Most people will go, well, I thought it was just connecting with my body and my mind and my breath, but it's a spiritual practice. And, you know, there's no real way of getting around it. If people get really uncomfortable even with the word God in our culture. Mm-hmm. But if you take God out of the picture of yoga, it'd be like going to the beach and taking the ocean out. So
there. That's a good way of putting it.
That being said, everything about yoga and becoming a yogi is changing our consciousness. Mm-hmm. The thing that differentiates somebody who's just doing Eastern calisthenics, which is the contortions and the movements and the breath and the different asanas, and someone who is on a spiritual practice, is someone who is recognizing what yoga really is and is endeavoring for it on a daily basis. It's a consciousness that designates somebody as a yogi. So even Patanjali, when he talks about food, the word ahimsa means to create the least amount of harm as possible. In yoga, everything is really about operating in a realistic manner. They know that you can't live in a world like we live in without creating some kind of harm. It is impossible. Mm-hmm. And when I say they, I'm referring to the ancient wisdom of the sages and saints of the past. People like Vedavyasadeva and Madhvacharya, these incredible scholars that have compiled these texts over thousands of years that are relevant today. Most people look at the things that are in Patanjali's Eight Sutras and discard them as some kind of archaic scripture that is so outdated and they can't apply it to their current situation, when in reality it's very, very relevant. And it's kind of this way of us escaping change to say it's something that it is outdated and we can't apply it. But when in reality we can really apply it to our life. And when they say creating the least amount of harm as possible, it's like this. I could be a vegan, but every time I take a shower and I put soap on my body, I am basically creating a genocide of bacteria all over my body. Like, I don't know if anybody's ever taken a microscope and looked at your skin, but there's like these little crocodile-looking microscopic things, and there's trillions of them all over your body. And when you shower, you're just wiping them out. You walk across a field, you're going to step on ants, you're going to step on creatures that are underneath the soil, and you're going to create harm. Mm-hmm. So it's, how do I create the least amount of harm as possible? In all of my yoga studios in the East Coast and the West Coast, I have this specific Sanskrit writing on the wall in each yoga room, and it says, Aham Brahmasmi, which means I am spirit, I am a soul. This is the fundamental principles that we start to look at when we are beginning our journey into yoga philosophy. There are things that are the baseline for studying yoga philosophy. And the first thing is we have to recognize that I'm not a material body. Mm-hmm. This material shell is very temporary. And I am something else. I am a spiritual being that is inhabiting this material body. And when I start to realize that not only am I a soul that's residing in this body, but there is a soul residing in every material body here that goes with insects, bacteria, plants, animals, all earthlings There's a soul that is giving it life, that is giving it consciousness. And then this always enters into another question that people ask, well, if you just said that there are souls and everything, even plants, then how is even eating a plant-based diet less harmful than eating a meat-based diet, since there's a soul in a carrot body, there's a soul in a cow body, one for one. Like, what's up, Tamal?
exactly.
And there's a really good answer for it, because, like I said, ahimsa means creating the least amount of harm as possible. So it's not just one for one when we look at it in the big picture of life. Let's give the example. You take the life of a cow, or you take the life of a carrot. Mm-hmm. You take the life of a cow, it's not just taking this one large creature, but you have to understand that the average cow needs to weigh 1,000 pounds. And mm-hmm. just like all creatures of this earth, it needs to eat food, metabolize it to create or to keep homeostasis, to create the body that is currently wearing and let it grow and grow and grow. So like a cow needs to eat about 16 to 20 pounds of grains to create 1 pound of beef. Mm-hmm. And it has to weigh 1,000 pounds in order for it to be taken to slaughter. So if you think about what is 20 pounds times 1,000, it's going to come up with this crazy number. And then not only that, but a cow also needs to drink 2,500 gallons of water in order to make 1 pound of beef. And if you were to times 1,000 pounds, because that's the average size of the one cow, times 2,500 gallons of water, that's 2,500,000 gallons of water for one cow. That's enough water resources to float an entire Navy destroyer ship with all its planes and crew and everything on it, one cow.
Wow.
So, and I don't know if how many people that are listening to this cook, but a cow needs to eat 16 to 20 pounds of grain to create 1 pound of beef. There's a lot of steakhouses in America that serve a whole pound steak as one meal.
Wow.
So it took about 20 pounds of grain to make that 1 pound. It's a bad exchange. It's like, okay, here's a $100 bill. I only want a dollar back. The exchange rate is terrible. And if you cook, how much does one cup of rice make when you cook it? It doubles its size. One cup of rice turns to 2 cups of rice. One cup of quinoa turns to 2 cups. Everything doubles its size. And if you do the statistics, that 20 pounds of grain could feed a whole village when that 20 pounds of grain actually went to make 1 1-pound steak or a few hamburgers for a couple of people versus being able to use those resources to feed a lot of people. You ended up killing tons, an unnecessary amount of plants in order to make a smaller amount of food, taking tons and tons of water, an unnecessary amount to make a smaller amount of food. Not to mention that animal agriculture is in the top three of the most polluting forms of destruction in the entire world. One of the leading causes of global warming. It's the number one reason for deforestation. I don't know how many people have you ever watched this thing that's on YouTube? It's really great. It's wolves were reintroduced into Yellowstone National Park.
Oh, I don't think I've seen that one.
Just, you can type it in, wolves reintroduced into Yellowstone National Park. And it's really great because it drives a point home that when everything goes into its balance, into its quota, everything is set in place to perfection, where nothing is out of whack. Mm-hmm. So in Yellowstone National Park, they killed all the wolves in this, I forget, was the 60s or 70s. And they do this time lapse in this video of what Yellowstone National Park looks like over the next 30 years. And it just greatly deteriorates. It becomes trashed. Dams dry up. Foreign predators come in, chase the natural creatures that live in Yellowstone National Park out. It just turns into total chaos. Foreign weeds and plants grow. The whole thing starts to fall apart and go into this collapse. All these scientists get together and they realize the thing that's been missing for all these years is the wolf. So they take a small pack of wolves and they reintroduce them into the park. What ends up happening is it's not that the wolves killed so many animals and like created this massive reorganization and order. But what it did was just their presence changed everything. Cause I don't know if anybody has dogs, but a dog always urinates and marks his territory. And it's for not only other wolves or dogs to smell, but it's for other creatures to smell, and they start to get scared. So these wolves are urinating everywhere. These foreign predators got scared and started to scatter. The wolves started hunting and taking out different animals. All the natural animals started to show back up, like the beaver, and started building dams. And they do this time lapse of once the wolves are reintroduced, the river started flowing, the weeds disappeared, the natural vegetation grew, and everything went back into balance. And it's really an example of what's going on in this world right now. In the yoga system, they say we're all allotted a certain amount. In the Bhagavad Gita, it talks about a quota. And if we step outside our quota, everything goes out of balance. And they talk about our quota as human beings is we are given plant foods. Even in the Bible, they talk about it. Every fruit-bearing seed shall be your food, they talk about in the Old Testament. So in the Bhagavad Gita, when they say you are given this natural quota of food, it is plant foods. And when you step outside those plant foods, everything goes out of whack. Something I like to drive home for people to kind of digest and use as their food for thought is there are a little over 7 billion people on the planet right now. And all these government officials get together, the UN gets together, and they talk about world hunger. And they all say, well, you know, there's just not enough food for everybody, so we got to figure this out. There's just not enough food. That's why there's 1 billion human beings that are starving here in this world. 1/7 of the entire world's population is starving. But
crazy.
There is over 50 billion, not million, 50 billion animals that are slaughtered and consumed and fed till they're morbidly obese every year. So just logic, how can we feed over 50 billion animals for animal agriculture till they're morbidly obese, but we can't feed this extra 1 billion human beings? Because what people don't understand is over 70% of all of our grains, produce, and food are not fed to human beings. It's fed to animals.
Yeah. And if I may interject for a moment, yeah. I'd like to say, you know, that I feel that one of the biggest things that we can do, obviously, is changing our diet and realizing that just like oil and gas, the agricultural business is a business. And that is one of the biggest reasons why there is a lot of talk about world hunger, but yet there isn't a lot of action towards changing that on a mass scale because of the amount of money that is profited each year off of exactly what you're talking about. So it's great that you're shedding light on the subject, because I think that when you put it so, it's so practical and reasonable that you can't even argue with it. You can't argue with the facts, because the reality is that if we want to see changes, it does have to start on an individual level. And I think a lot of people get overwhelmed with this idea of, well, I'm just one person. What can I do? You know, I can't save the whole world. But if everyone has that mentality, then nothing will ever change. But if more people have the mentality of, okay, you know, I want more organic food in my grocery store, I'll pay more and I get organic food in my grocery store. And then if everyone does that, then there's more organic food available. And it's these little small changes that start to happen. So I'm really glad that you are shedding light on that, because people do need to realize that they have a lot more power than they think that they do.
Yeah, I'm kind of taking this really long roundabout route of answering your first question about changing consciousness, but I feel like there needs to be multiple tiers and reasons for changing your consciousness, because the change in your consciousness not only changes you, but a change in your consciousness should have a kind of a ripple effect that changes the world. That's when you know you're on the right path. It's not just a personal change, but whatever your actions do has this trajectory of altering the space around you. And when it comes to like this whole animal agriculture thing, you know, there's 50 billion animals that are consumed every year, but the irony is that many of the animals that are being raised and used for food are all raised in these countries where starvation is rampant.
Wow.
Because what happens is all these poor countries use all their produce, all their natural resources to feed these animals, and those animals get shipped off to the United States and Europe and all these places where we can afford it. It's this vicious cycle. There's a wonderful saying that says, if everybody in this earth wants to eat a meat-based diet, you will need two planet Earths. But if everybody ate a plant-based diet, you could feed two planet Earths. So it's just like Yellowstone National Park. If we go inside our quota and we eat plant-based foods and we follow this principle of ahimsa that is set out thousands of years ago, that is not an archaic concept, that is not some outdated literature, and actually if we follow it, all of a sudden there's going to be more water than we can use. There's going to be more food than we could ever imagine. There'll be less pollution in the world, and everything goes back into its natural balance. The rivers of resources start to flow correctly. But it's only when we step outside our quota do things get kind of crazy. Now, the other part about consciousness is there's these things called the three modes of material nature, or the gunas, that are in the Bhagavad Gita. They're reiterated everywhere. It's sattva, rajas, and tamas, which is goodness, passion, and ignorance. So everything in life, we always want to become more conscious. We don't want to be less conscious. We very rarely hear people say, you know what, I want to be in a lot of ignorance today. And when we sit down to eat a meal, most of the time, if you start sitting with family and friends, which I have many family and friends that are not plant-based, and you start talking about where their food came from, they're going to say, could you please stop? You're making me lose my appetite. I want to ignore where this came from.
Oh yeah. I've heard that one before for sure.
Yeah. And the root word of ignore is ignorance, right? So in order for people to say, hey, could you stop talking about where my food came from? I want to put myself in ignorance to ignore where my food came from in order to engage in this activity. That's something we need to greatly address in our own life. There shouldn't be places in our life where we go, I need to put myself in ignorance to ignore something in order to engage in this activity. All of a sudden, you realize you're running into problems. You're becoming less conscious. You should be able to sit and eat your meal and watch a video of where it comes from with no problem. If you sat down and you put in a show like Earthlings or some really heavy thing documentary about what goes on in animal agriculture, most people have a very hard time finishing their meal. But if you actually watch a documentary on vegetables being harvested and all these things like that, you'll be able to do it no problem. It's because there is this defining line that can be crossed over any time they talk about in yoga of jumping from the mode of ignorance to passion, passion to goodness, or back and forth. And we want to stay on this straightforward path of staying in mode of goodness and eventually even transcending that and going into a place called the Vasudev state, which is God consciousness, which is even higher than goodness.
Yeah. You know, it's interesting because there's two things that I thought of when you were saying that. And one, you're saying about how people want to remain in the state of ignoring and ignorance so that they can justify their behavior or justify what they're doing. And, you know, that is kind of similar to people who, you know, maybe go out on the weekend and get really drunk and do things that they wouldn't do, normally, but they are putting themselves into the mode of ignorance. While I was drunk, so I, you know, I'm going to let loose and do all of these things. And, you know, I feel like that's something that, I guess my eyes were wide open to after coming back from my yoga course and my yoga training, once you remove those things, you remove the, I would call that like the sort of ignorant patterns and behaviors, you become conscious of them and aware of them, and you start to remove them, and you start to experience this kind of yoga high or bliss or whatever you want to call it. It's a different state of consciousness. You start to realize how much better you feel when you start to eliminate those sort of, I call them pollutants, from your existence. And I think, just for anyone that's listening to this, the zig and zag process, you know, you're talking about Rajas, Tamas, and Sattva, you know, there's such a zig and a zag process, like you're tuning a guitar, you know, the string can't be too tight, it can't be too loose before it plays that beautiful note. But I think that that is one of the greatest gifts that yoga has given me. And so I really like what you said about that. Before we go further into some other queries I have for you, where can people buy your book? Because I definitely want to put that out there so people know where they can get it.
Yeah, so the book is The Yoga Plate. It can be purchased at any Barnes and Nobles. It's on Amazon. It's kind of everywhere.
Awesome.
Which is great. So it shouldn't be hard to find. I believe we're featured on Amazon for this month of December, which is pretty great.
Oh, that's awesome.
There's like three cookbooks and we're one of the three. I don't know what the other two are, but yeah, you can check it out. Barnes & Noble's, Amazon. You can Google it. There's going to be a ton of other private sellers that are out there.
Awesome. Okay. Well, I'm definitely going to put that in my links when I post our podcast, because I'll be posting it by next week. And I feel like I'm excited. I'm excited to get a copy, because everything that you've been saying are things that I've been thinking about. And so I think it's a good message for people to, contemplate and to start putting into practice. Cause like you said, it is possible to live the Yoga Sutras. It's just a process of becoming more conscious and aware. And, yeah. Do you think that, I know you grew up in Hawaii, right?
Yeah, I was born in Hawaii, and we bounced back and forth between Hawaii and Los Angeles. My father was kind of a B-list movie star, TV star. He was, in the 80s, he was a star of General Hospital, was on Miami Vice and Magnum PI and all these like hilarious 80s shows.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, that's kind of how he made his living, to sustain his seven kids and to support these people who are staying in our house at all times. I was raised in we called it a yoga ashram. A yoga ashram is just a word for a place of learning yoga, but learning yoga as a lifestyle, not just coming there for an hour and rolling out a yoga mat, but we're living there day in and day out, meditating, reading, engaging in prayer, chanting, kirtans. My father had a very, very wild and interesting life. By the age of 15, he became a monk. He traveled through India with nothing but the clothes on his back and a begging bowl.
Sadhana. He is a sadhu.
Running around through India as this young teenager. Ended up back in Hawaii after going through Thailand and Malaysia and everything like that. And started a family and made his home this place where people could come and study and grow and learn. And it's funny, I was just writing about this yesterday, about kind of my upbringing and what kind of spawned this specific inspiration to share this stuff with the rest of the yoga community, because it does get missed and it doesn't get touched upon that often. But most people think, oh, you grew up in a yoga ashram. It was probably like this monastery on top of a mountain in Hawaii and all this stuff. But really, it was wherever we lived and it was our home. It wasn't anything glamorous. We always had a guest house or garage that was gutted out and beds would put as a dorm. People would come in from Australia, Thailand, India, Europe, and then come live with us. And we'd have like 20, 30 strangers hanging out, learning, and some would stay for a couple of days, some would stay for weeks, some would stay for a year or more. And it was all donation based. People just gave what they could give. All the kids were homeschooled. We grew up very bohemian, as you can tell. And kind of the role of each day was we'd wake up in the morning, we would all get together and have some bhajans or kirtans. My father would give a philosophy talk. Some people call those dharma talks, but he's giving a philosophy talk. And then we would have some food, which is called prasadam when it's offered, which means God's mercy or spiritual food. And then after that, some people would go work a job, leave the ashram. Some people would stay, and we had a big garden, would work the garden, and kids would do their homework. People would come in the late afternoon, and we'd have another kirtan. We'd go over some specific ceremonies, such as artik and spiritual offerings. Then we would have another philosophy talk, prasadam, more kirtan, another philosophy talk. And then we'd go to bed and start it all over. We did do some yoga postures, but it wasn't the main, it wasn't the core of what was going on there. Most people don't understand. It's like there's 30 million Americans practicing yoga here in the United States. But about 99.9% of everybody is mostly going to yoga studios and having a physical practice.
Mm-hmm.
And it's fading a lot in India, but originally, you know, it's the majority of the population are practicing yoga in India, but it's the spiritual aspects and small amount is the physical stuff. It's reversed from culture to culture. So it was my father's like mission to help people have not only the knowledge, but experiential knowledge of what it was all about. What that means is we can go through life. He called it armchair philosophy. We could go sit at, you know, a plant-based restaurant or a coffee shop and say, yeah, man, I was reading the Bhagavad Gita. I was reading this book. I was reading that book. I was reading this. And we just talk about it all day, but we're not actually putting it into action.
Mm-hmm.
And like it says in the Bhagavad Gita, you'll never actually understand the knowledge that is in the Vedas unless you're applying it. You need experiential knowledge to understand what's going on. I give this example a lot.
Yeah, you know, you can read all you want, but it's not true knowledge. True knowledge is when you're actually living it. And I find it fascinating, actually, that your father was such a spiritual seeker and an explorer at such a young age, because that's something I can relate to. I guess ever since I was like a small child, I remember going to Sunday school at like age 5 and them talking about God, and I'm like, okay, but then who created God? And I had all these questions, and my family is not religious by any means, but I have gone through a process through my life of questioning, and it finally led me to yoga, but you know, it was a process of going to a Christian church. I would take the bus ride over across to the other city, across the river. I'd go to church. I decided, nah, they're trying to control me. I don't like that. That was around age 13. And then I guess I started meditating and trying to figure out why I was here, what my life meant, probably around age 16, 17. Then I started going to the Hare Krishna temple. And I finally ended up in India at 22. And that really broke my whole sort of concept of myself and my existence and what life is and this higher power, God. I'm not uncomfortable to say the word God, and believing that there was some sort of bigger picture. And I think that when you have this knowing inside of you, it's who you are born to be, and you go out seeking and looking for these answers. It's quite a wild ride of going through periods of like having faith, losing faith, and having faith again, kind of like the zig and the zag. Like I know with your father, you know, you're saying that that was who he was. Did you ever yourself ever experience moments of like losing faith or wondering or questioning things? Like, has that been a part of your spiritual journey, if I'm allowed to ask that?
Absolutely. And, you know, of course you have, and I've had moments where you're up and down, everything in between, twisted and turned around. I'm not going to pretend that I have had no time or moments where, you know, you have an immense lack of faith and you're slipping into a place where you don't want to be. That's mm-hmm. part of the spiritual journey. It's like you ever see a heart monitor and it's going up and down, up and down, up and down, like doot, 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 right? Mm-hmm. That's life. It's going to be up and down, up and down. And usually when it's flatlined, you're dead. So you're going to have those up and downs. Mm-hmm. Usually when there's a down, I always say, well, you know what? There's only one place to go is up. So when it comes to this process of gaining faith, it's also through experiential knowledge. What I was going to touch upon is, let's say you wanted to surf, but you never did surf. All you did was read books about surfing, and all you did was talk about surfing for 20 years with people. You've never actually surfed before, never been on a surfboard. And after 20 years, somebody gives you a shortboard, a 5'6" little fish board, and they say, go out there. You've read every book there is to know on surfing. You've learned every technique by just reading it. Now go out there. How many people do you think will be able to go out there, drop in a wave, start doing airs and flips and turns?
Oh, you'd be swallowing water in no time.
If anybody's surfed before, it's like the hardest thing in the world. So you could read as many books as you want and philosophize about surfing as long as you want. But if you actually don't go out surfing, you're never going to be able to do what you were reading about, because there's no practice and no experience of it, no firsthand experience. Mm-hmm. And that's how it is with yoga philosophy. You could talk about it, philosophize about it all day, but unless you're applying it, you're never going to really know what it's all about. You just won't. There's this incredible allegory by a guy named Frank Jackson. He wrote this thing called Mary's Room. I don't know if you're familiar with it, but Mary's room is, let's say there's this woman, her name is Mary, and she is an expert on color. She has read every book there is on color and how the eye registers color and how that translates in the brain to perceiving color. And she knows more about color theoretically than anyone else. However, she has only lived her entire life in a black and white room with black and white books and has a black and white computer. One day, Mary is on her computer and there's a glitch in the screen and a red apple appears for the first time. Does her understanding of color stay the same, or does it increase by seeing color for the first time? You would argue it would, because experience, theory and experience are two different things. For instance, when you're a kid, you could say, Mom, Dad, what's love like? And they tell you, and then you fall in love. Did your idea and your understanding of love change? Yes. Mm-hmm. You ask somebody, what does ice cream taste like? And somebody tells you, it's creamy, it's sweet, and you have this idea, but then you eat it for the first time. Does your understanding of it increase? Is there more depth behind it? Yes. You go through anything in life, when there is firsthand experiential knowledge, you have this newfound understanding, because it's deep. It's this visceral experience. And that's yoga philosophy. And so my father, in this ashram setting, he was really into not only giving people the knowledge, but teaching them how to apply it. For instance, he wanted people to understand what kirtan was all about. So we would have these crazy long kirtans. One time he had us chant and have a kirtan for 24 hours straight.
Oh, wow. You must have been feeling really good by the end.
But there was things like that going on all the time. And it's really crazy, because I'll run into people that had stayed at an ashram, and you know, I was like a little kid. I was like 7 or 8 and things like that. I'll run into these people and they are forever changed by that time of their life. Even if people had stopped practicing yoga, they will have never fully let go of it. For instance, I ran into one of our friends that had stayed in the ashram, and he doesn't really live a yoga lifestyle that much. However, he had some mala beads on him. And I was like, oh, he's still chanting on your japa beads, your mala beads. And he's like, yep, you never know when you need to make a phone call. And he never let go of certain specific principles that he was taught, because it impacted him, because he had experiential knowledge. He had a taste. Yoga, just like we have classes on a class schedule, it says, beginners, level one, intermediate, level two, two, three, all these things. Well, that's the physical practice. In yoga, they say there are three different stages in people's spiritual life. There's Kanistha Adhikari, which is the beginning, the neophyte, the seedling of our spiritual life. That's where we have the most ups and downs. That's where our faith wavers. But as we practice more, we make life changes more, we serve more, we get to a place called Majjhima Adhikari, which is intermediate, middle stage of your spiritual life. This is where you become very balanced. You become very steady on the path, or Nista. And then above that is Uttama Adhikari, which is a fully enlightened person. And the only way we go through these different stages and the only way we get to that final Uttama Adhikari is unflinching trust in something divine and following the path of yoga and listening to these writings that are written out and paved by Patanjali or in the Bhagavad Gita by Krishna, and applying these principles to your life with all of your heart, all of your mind, your entire being. And when you do that, and you follow this roadmap, it leads you to a destination. It's not leading you to nowhere. So if you have faith that that is going to take you to the destination, it'll take you there. There's an amazing part in the Bhagavad Gita where Arjuna is having this conversation with Krishna, and he's going through so much turmoil because of the circumstances he's in. And he says, "I am your disciple, a soul surrendered unto you." And he says a very specific word. He says "sishya," which means disciple, but certain things don't translate so perfectly from Sanskrit to English. There's so much more profound qualities in the Sanskrit. And what "sishya" means is, I'm willing to trust everything that you say to be true. And that's something really hard for our Western culture, because, you know, so many people have a negative taste in their mouth when it comes to religion and specific aspects of spirituality because of the things that were done in the name of religion. You know, people will have done wars and all these horrible things in the name of religion, and then they get turned off by it. When, you know, if we're getting really, really detailed here, all the negative things that are done in the name of religion, whether it's Christianity, had nothing to do with Jesus's teachings. Mm-hmm. All the negative things that were ever done in the name of yoga, it's nothing to do with the teachings in Patanjali or the Bhagavad Gita.
Yeah, it's the people. It's the people's perception and interpretation of the teachings. I was just having a conversation with a friend from India, and this is what he was saying. He says, you know, it's not, you know, people take what Jesus said, but it's what they're saying. It's not what maybe Jesus was interpreting or what he was saying at all, or what Krishna was saying. It's a human being's perception and interpretation of what they are saying. And things can get very twisted. And
the thing about yoga too, it's like in this ancient book called the Srimad Bhagavatam, there is a part where Kapila says about yoga. He goes through the whole process of yoga, and Kapila predates Patanjali. Kapila writes that after he goes through the processes of pranayama, asana, and controlling your air and all these different things, he goes through this whole process of yoga that's also mapped out by Patanjali, and he says, by this process or any other true process, one can attain enlightenment. And this is why yoga is non-denominational, non-sectarian. It's because he says, by this process or any other true process. He's not saying this is the only one. And when you start to look at, like, people will get really shocked when they come into my yoga teacher trainings, and I'll start talking about the Bible and start talking about different literatures. I even go into Buddhism and things like that, because there's so many common truths and common things that are there, that if you start to connect the dots, you come to this profound conclusion that everybody is actually worshiping and moving the direction of the same God. It's not just a bunch of multiple different gods, or your God's your God, my God's my God. It's more, everyone's trying to create some kind of segregation. When you actually look at Jesus's teachings, he was asked, what is the greatest commandment? What's the most important thing for us to know? What is the meaning of life, is what was asked to Jesus. And he said, to love God with all your heart, all your mind, your entire being. And the second is like unto it, love your neighbor as thyself. And that's actually bhakti yoga. There's this word prema bhakti in the yoga system, and it means pure love of God. That's where we're headed. Same thing. Love God with all your heart, all your mind, your entire being. Prema bhakti, love God fully. So when you start to see things like that, you start to see this big picture of commonalities, and it becomes very unifying.
Mm-hmm. So if you were to, in your teacher trainings, to go over some of these obviously very important key aspects of yoga that I feel is lacking in a lot of the yoga world, would you ever actually, I've got another question before I jump to that one. Would you ever consider creating an ashram like your dad did?
Yeah, I'm in the midst of working on a nonprofit right now called Meditation Campus. There's actually 8 lectures on there that I've given that are all podcasts on philosophy. And eventually there's going to be not only an astronomical amount of lectures on there, but there's going to be kind of a quiz after each lecture that people can take to test their understanding of what was actually said and what was actually in the Vedas. Because a lot of people think they have a grasp on it, but there isn't a full solid grasp on it, because people assume that whatever they Google is going to be actually the real answers to things, when there's so much confusing, muddled information that is out there that is not going to give you a clear picture. And so it's important for people to actually study firsthand what's in the Vedas versus Googling things saying, I found the answer, and being able to go through this checklist, because once they have a clear understanding, they can start to apply things in a very chronological order without things getting all messed up. So there's going to be that on the site. There's also going to be courses firsthand. I want to have literally a campus for philosophy where people come in and they'll take courses. And it's all nonprofit. And people will come in for, you know, a 3-week course, a 2-week course, and they'll study, learn, practice. And then they can go and they can come back and take different courses throughout the year. So that's in the works. There will also be some video lectures. It'll be very interactive. And then, you know, I also have started to do this where I do, I don't want to say, make it sound like it's exclusive, but it's invite only to people who have done an X amount of philosophy talks. So mm-hmm. I do these things called meditation modules at all my yoga studios, where people will take 8 philosophy talks that give them the foundational principles of yoga understanding. And then after that, they can come on these completely nonprofit retreats. People are just literally paying for the cost of their airfare and their food. And they spend a whole weekend, usually 3 to 4 days, where we just get immersed and engulfed in yoga teaching. So I just did one recently in October. We're doing them once or twice a year. And we have a ton of people in Los Angeles, also here in the East Coast, that all collect together and just are constantly doing these retreats. So they're not necessarily exclusive if you come and take a philosophy program at any of the studios.
Okay.
Because what I don't want people to do is to sign up for these private retreats with zero understanding, because we're picking up from where we left off.
Mm-hmm.
If that makes sense.
Oh yeah.
It means if you didn't have the philosophy beforehand, you're coming into a middle of a conversation.
Right.
And you'll get very lost. So it's for everyone else's benefit that they have taken these philosophy modules, and then they can go further from there.
So they would come to your studio, which is in Los Angeles, and they
or the East Coast one. I'm not the only person who leads them.
Okay.
And they'll take they're called meditation modules, and people get these 8 talks, and then after they're done, they can just sign up and start taking these meditation retreats all the time.
Okay. And is this all available, like this information, on your website?
Yeah, it comes up on our website under the workshop page.
Okay.
We have one in the books right now, but they do come up quite often.
And your website is?
It's yogasalt.com.
Awesome. Okay. Just because I feel like people are going to be hopping on Google right now. That's awesome. Yeah, actually, you've got some yoga teacher trainings that are coming up. And I have been looking into it. You said to check it out. I have been. Yeah. I've been looking into it, because you've got the 300-hour, which is in Costa Rica, right?
Yeah.
Okay. So, and that one's 3 weeks long?
Yeah, that one's 3 weeks long, and it's in Santa Teresa, Costa Rica, the end of May through mid-June.
Okay. All right. And then will the students be eating from the yoga plate menu?
I won't be catering it. There's going to be another chef that's on there.
Yeah.
I'll be busy teaching it, but there will be all plant-based food and it'll be really good. And every now and then I hop in and make something out of the book that'll be available, but it won't be every day.
Okay. Well, and people can find all that information as well on yogasalt.com.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Okay, perfect. Well, I know, I can't believe it's already been an hour. I've got a couple more things I want to ask you. I'm going through my footnotes and I'm like, no, I'm going to have you come back another time because there's so many things. How many of our experiences become trapped in our body if we don't have a proper, outlet, or maybe we aren't taught how to process our feelings, and maybe we learn to stuff things inside and keep them to ourselves or whatever it may be. I feel like there's, you know, a lot of different reasons for that, but what do you believe about negative thoughts manifesting as illness or emotional trauma becoming trapped in the body and manifesting as pain or disease?
Mm-hmm. I think there's a couple things in there. In psychology, they have this thing called the internal locus of control and the external locus of control. So there are two people they categorize. There's those who say there's an internal locus of control, meaning I control my own life. There is no God. Everything that happens is because of me and my decisions, so on and so forth. Then there's the external locus of control where people live their life. I have no control. God is in control of everything. Whatever happens is God's will, and that's how things fall into place. It wouldn't be either or. It would be both. I have control because I've been given free will, and God is the one who gave me free will, and God is in control. So we're allotted a certain amount of control. And so we make choices and decisions. That being said, when it comes to emotional trauma, negative emotions, negative thought processes that we are kind of putting out there in the world, and they do have ramifications, I'd be very ignorant if I were to say, oh, stress and things like that have no negative ramifications. They definitely do. Mm-hmm. But in yoga, they say that a lot of that comes from misidentifying with our material body. So there's this whole thing that is all over the yoga community right now. And everyone talks about it, self-care, like self-care. Mm-hmm. I'm going to go on a spa day, get my nails done and drink a mimosa and get a massage. And you hear this stuff going on all the time when the self-care thing comes from the Sanskrit concept in Ayurveda called Dinacharya. Dinacharya is the word for self-care. But when you actually start to look at part of it, don't get me wrong, it's amazing to go get massages and take care of the material body. You have to do that, otherwise it will fall apart. Mm-hmm. But the first part of self-care is understanding who the self is. Understanding that I'm not this material body. If you look at Dinacharya, they talk about the things that you do for the soul and the spiritual practice of regularly chanting, praying, reading, helping other people, living as a spiritual being while living in a material world. And when we start to properly identify as being a spiritual being, having a material experience, and that we start to develop our relationship with God, and we have trust that God is in control, all of a sudden, a lot of our anxiety and our fear and everything starts to diminish. My father's spiritual teacher was asked, what do you experience when you chant or have a kirtan? He said, I experience fearlessness. So when we actually practice the process of yoga and we understand that I am a spirit, a soul, a jiva atma, and my relationship with God is going to be the most important relationship. Like in yoga, they talk about how God is our eternal soulmate. You know, we're always looking for that one specific person, right? That's going to make it all just click and perfect. And we're going to ride off into the sunset. but nobody ever talks about that. You're going to find this person, but there's going to be a point in your life where you're both going to leave your body. Mm-hmm. There's going to be a point in your life where you're going to have to let go of that person. And people will go, oh my God, Simone, this is really heavy. Why do you have to talk about that? We have to talk about the elephant in the room. Otherwise we'll never address it. And it's just going to be always lingering and so scary and fearful. When we realize that relationships, whether there are family relationships, fraternal relationships, maternal relationships, or conjugal relationships, they should all be spiritually centered. In yoga, they actually have three stages of a relationship, romantic relationships, in the order they go in. Do you want to hear them?
Yeah, I do.
First stage is infatuation. That's where you're like, oh my God, you're perfect. I love you. There's nothing wrong about you. You're incredible. We will never fight. Oh my God, we never fight. It's amazing. You hear that stuff happen. The second stage is tolerance. That's where you're like, you know what? There are some things wrong with you. And guess what? We're about to fight. It's getting real. You never take out the trash. And things like that start to unfold. And this is the stage where most people break up, divorce happens, things fall apart. And no judgment. I know that some people are just not meant to be together. Mm-hmm. But the only way you'll get to the third stage, they say, is if your relationship is not just physically, materially based. It's got to be spiritually based. The only way you get to the third stage is if you both understand you're not these material bodies, that you're a spirit soul, and that we should be helping each other on the path of yoga to relinking with God. We're helping each other develop our lost love for our eternal soulmate. And if you do that, you can get to the last stage, which is true friendship. And nothing will break that. You know, people get their best friend and they're like, oh, could never not be friends with this. This is my best friend. You'll never get to that best friend stage unless God is at the center. And when they talk about this in yoga, this is very much so reality. You know, physical attraction is important. That's one of the reasons we get into a relationship. You first get physically attracted. That's why, you know, these social ways of dating, like, you know, Tinder and all these things, are just looking at people. Mm-hmm. Right? You're not even talking to them, mate. Just swipe right, swipe left. Right? It's just a visual attraction is the first way it starts, which is the most superficial thing. Mm-hmm. So if you think about that, you don't know who the person is, what they're like, but you're just looking at the photo and you're attracted to them. But many relationships in our culture, through the entire time people aren't even together, it's still based off that initial thing of just the superficial physical attraction. And you see this time and time again. I read articles where somebody gets in a fatal car accident and they get disfigured and they're in the hospital, and all of a sudden their significant other leaves them. Ugh. Because it was physically based, superficially mm-hmm. based. If you understand that this person, I don't just love the body. I actually love the soul. That's who I really love. I love the Jiva Atma that is residing in that person's heart, that is giving that person life. Mm-hmm. And I'm going to help that person attain higher consciousness. I'm going to help them foster spiritual growth in their life, no matter what happens to their physical frame. It's going to be very hard to break that one. So when we live this spiritual life, whether you're with someone or not with somebody, when you have faith that there is something greater than us, there's something bigger, and the real process of yoga is this reconnecting with God, you'll be able to dispel fear, anxiety, and have so much more trust and relaxed nature of walking through this world with grace.
Do you think that there's a certain amount of when you enter into these kinds of relationships? Because I agree with what you're saying, you know, romance aside, friendship is the only thing that can truly sustain a relationship long-term, you know, like as you're saying, the body ages, things happen. But do you feel that, you know, it's easy enough to take care of yourself and to go on your own spiritual journey when you don't have to consider anybody else? But when you're in a relationship, it becomes like an entirely different spiritual journey. Do you think that there's a certain amount of like a cleansing process where you bring things out in one another? Is that part of the healing? Just curious, absolutely. You know, because I feel like I saw a post of yours, I think it was a few months back, and it was about families that pray together. So my partner and I have actually been praying every night and morning together, and it's actually been really beautiful. So I wanted to say thank you for that as well.
Oh, I'm glad.
Yeah.
My father used to give this example where he used to say spiritual life is like a dirty bucket. You have this dirty bucket and it's just caked with junk, and you start to pour pure water into it. What ends up happening is all the dirt that is caked to the inside of the bucket starts to peel off. And all of a sudden you look like you made a mess of the situation. Now it looks like you have a dirty bucket full of dirty water. But as you keep pouring water into the bucket, all the crud and impurities start to overflow and fall outside the bucket. And all of a sudden, over time, you have nothing but a clean bucket with clear water, but it's a cleansing process. So you're going to have ups and downs. You're going to feel like you're getting worse versus getting better. You're going to feel the swings of everything coming in and out. It's going to be a storm for a while, but the more you stay steady and you engage in your spiritual practice, the more you're going to clean and cleanse out your heart, and you're going to have that real clarity, that real spiritual understanding.
Yeah, you know, because that's the thing. I feel like there is a lot of unrealistic expectation about not just the spiritual world, but about relationships and life in general. We're kind of brainwashed from a really early age, and it's not always like a healthy brainwashing. It's often not. And so, you know, I think to have a realistic understanding of what that looks like, because, you know, you were saying, if the relationship is superficial, I think that can often, that's not going to sustain it no matter what you do. There has to be like a real connection there and love each other on a soul level. So, you know, I think that that's just a really beautiful way of giving people just another take on relationships, and the fact that they do take work, and it is a spiritual process of its own, and it is a cleansing process. And I think that one of the most important things that we have to remind ourselves of is, it's so basic, but, you know, to treat another how we would want to be treated, and to not just love them for what they can do or have all the expectations and things like that, but to actually really truly love that person on a deep soul level. And it just hit 11:11 as I was saying this. My partner will find that significant as I'm talking about this. But, you know, it's, I think having a more realistic expectation about it is a process and it is a journey. And I think that if both in the union have the same sort of goal, which is, like you said, this God realization or just a true path in that sense, I think that you can actually really help each other to shed a lot of those heavy patterns that will just keep coming up over and over. So
we all come into this world with a lot of baggage, a lot of luggage. In the yoga system, it says we have reincarnated millions of times, not a couple. We've had millions of births. And until you become a fully enlightened person, you're going to have a lot of luggage, a lot of baggage, a lot of things from past lives, a lot of things that are going to come up in your relationships. And if you're cleansing together, but let's say you decide to do like a colon cleanser, a candida cleanse, everybody's going to get smelly. Everyone's going to get crabby. Everybody, that's just from the physical cleanse. Now imagine if you're doing a spiritual cleanse, all this stuff's going to come out, and you may fight, you may have arguments and things like that. However, if you stay the course, you will get clear, and everybody will come out feeling and acting way different. Something my father used to share with me is that whenever you're in a relationship, somebody always has to take a humble position in an argument and apologize first. If there's no apology, nothing will get resolved. And if somebody starts taking the humble position and apologizing first, the other person is going to start recognizing it, and they'll start beating you to the punch.
Mm. Yeah, you know, also, as you were saying this, I was thinking, you know, the more, you know, you go through the arguments and the process of cleansing, I think it's important to be familiar with those places inside of yourself that you would maybe not otherwise see if you're like, ah, I don't like this person anymore. I don't like that person anymore. I don't like this person anymore. And you just keep, you know, pointing a finger at the issue being with the other person and fault finding rather than being really truthfully honest with yourself, which is a huge part of the spiritual process. Really looking at your crap, basically, mm-hmm. and the right person coming into your life can do that and be almost like a mirror for you. So thank you for sharing that, because I really like the way that you put things. I'm just going to say that you have a great way of clearly expressing a lot of spiritual philosophies and principles that I think is easy for people to really understand. So I wanted to say thank you for that.
Well, I can't say that I can take credit for any of it, because all it is there's this very specific statement in the Vedas where they talk about how everybody should be following a parampara, or which means a disciplic succession. And they give this example of a mango tree. Mm-hmm. So in India or Hawaii, there's mango season. And when it's mango season, you climb up to the very top of the tree, because the ripest mangoes are the ones at the top facing the sun, because the sunlight makes them soft, makes them sweet, makes them ripen faster. One guy sits at the very top, one guy sits on a branch below him, another guy sits on a branch below him, another guy, and so forth, until there's somebody at the very bottom of the tree waiting with a little tiny towel. The guy at the very top picks the perfect mango and he gently hands it to the guy below him so it doesn't get bruised. That guy hands it down all the way until it gets to the bottom, where the other guy takes the mango, wraps it in a blanket, and puts it in a basket, unbruised, undamaged. So anything that I'm sharing is just my hope that I'm handing down that fruit of knowledge without banging it up at all and not bruising it.
Well, I think you're doing a good job.
But something I did want to say regarding just social life. So a lot of the times when people make changes and they start this process of really living a yoga lifestyle, there's going to be people that fall away from you. Mm. There's going to be people that don't get it. There's going to be people that think that you've changed. And guess what? You have. It's part of it. There is two words, dusanga and sarusanga, that is in yoga. You don't want to be around people who are going to drag your consciousness down. Mm. People who want you to stay in a dark, negative place, because misery loves company, isn't healthy for you spiritually. You love them, you respect them as a soul on their own journey through life, but doesn't mean you have to hang out with them, be with them all the time. Then there's people like, there's the sadhu sangha, which are people who are going to spiritually help you. It's like taking a guitar and plugging it into an amplifier, and they turn it up and they bring out the best in you and they make you flourish spiritually. They make you make active changes. That's the people you want to associate with. There's going to be a lot of friends and family that'll jump on the wagon with you and be like, wow, you've really changed. I want to be a part of this. I want to create positive change. I don't like this hamster wheel that our social climate has kind of brainwashed us to live, that more material things is the way of happiness, when everything in our material life is temporary. Everything here is a rental, from the car we have to the job we have, to even to the relationship we're in, to the house we're living in. Everything is a rental. A rental means something that you have or require for a short period of time. It's not forever. Hmm. When you pass away, you're not taking your car. You're not taking your bank account. You're not taking your husband or your wife or your significant other. You're not taking the body you're wearing. All that stays here. So understanding the thing that you're going to take with you is Sukriti, which is spiritual merit, spiritual knowledge, spiritual wisdom. Those are the only things that you're going to take, because the soul is not made of this temporary stuff. This body in yoga, they say, is made of earth, water, fire, air, ether, mind, intelligence, and false ego. The soul is Sat Chit Ananda Vigraha, which means it's eternal, full of knowledge, bliss, and form. And the only thing that can satisfy a spiritual being, and the only thing a soul, a spiritual being can take with it, is spiritual things. So spending our time with simple living and spiritual thinking and spiritual practice is going to be the eternal route.
Well, Tamal, you are absolutely lovely. I have enjoyed speaking with you, and I can't believe that our time is up already. I got to find a way to get to your 300-hour training.
Yeah, hit me
for
up.
Sure. Definitely
we'll figure
will.
Something out for you.
Sounds good. So how can people connect with you? I know you've got yogasalt.com. Can people get you on Instagram, Facebook?
Yeah, I'm at Tamal Dodge on Instagram and Tamal Dodge on Facebook. You can go to yogasalt.com and check out what I'm teaching, workshops, classes, and things like that. And that's about it.
Amazing. Awesome. Well, thank you so much for your time. And I will chat again with you soon, hopefully.
Yes, absolutely. Anytime. It's been awesome chatting with you as well.
Okay. Yeah, you as well. Hare Krishna.
Hare Bo.
Thanks for joining us today for another episode of the Shanti Ma Podcast. If you're enjoying the podcast so far, don't forget to subscribe. You can also show some love by becoming a Patreon member at patreon.com/Shanti Ma. That's patreon.com/SHANTIHMA. With your support, I'm able to provide you with more of what you love. I love you all. Thank you so much for listening. Have a wonderful day, afternoon, or evening, whatever your time zone is. Until next time, bye.